Welcome to the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Mover podcast series. Here you will get up close and personal with people who are taking giant steps for the betterment of cyclists and for the planet itself. We have with us here today from his offices in Sacramento, California, a fellow named Jox Graber. Jox is the ride leader for our annual 60-mile Folsom to Davis Gold Run Relay ride. Jox has been riding high wheel bikes for 2 decades. How you doing today, guy?
Oh, pretty good.
Okay, Jox, we know you ride a bike. What kind of work do you do?
I work for the state as an engineering geologist. I did the compliances with landfill designs in the state.
So does that job get you lots of opportunity to be out on your bicycle?
Well, it doesn't let me the activity to go out and ride a high wheel, but it does let me to get out of the office every once in a while to check out landfills and do site surveys and stuff. And sometimes I go into towns and I might run into somebody that has an old bike and something, one thing leads another, and I may make an acquisition.
I know you do a lot of work with the American River Bike Trail. Does your work qualify you for that?
Dealing with the American River Trail, all that stuff has nothing to do with working on my regular job. That's just one of my personal activities and, you might say, protective passions for the environmental cause.
Okay, so over and beyond river protection, you organized the first California AIDS ride. What year was that, Jox?
It was August 1983, and the whole crisis was just starting to become realized, and I had attended one of the first medical seminars in the nation, if not worldwide, dealing with the impending epidemic, and we spoke with many physicians who were already studying it under other names for about almost 2 years by that time, and I saw the grave danger and seriousness of it early before most anybody, especially anybody in the mainstream society and the mainstream press. And we were beginning to form organizations, of which one was the AIDS Foundation here in Sacramento, and then San Francisco was having their own foundation, that I decided to do, you might say, a geographic unification fundraising ride. And the idea was to ride symbolically, actually physically, but to symbolize the bond between Sacramento and the San Francisco communities by hosting a ride that would go from Sacramento at Castro Way here, which was a popular place for community activities, and I would ride down to the Castro Street Fair in San Francisco.
Okay, so that got muted just a little bit. Did you say Castro?
Yes, we have a street called Castro Way. It's down by 24th Avenue, 24th Street and 4th Avenue in Sacramento, and there's a community center there. And we did lots of plays and other community activities there, and it was a popular gathering spot for that time. And so I thought it was very appropriate. I called it the Castro Benefit for the Foundation.
So I guess at that point it was not called the AIDS Ride?
No, I just called it the Castro Benefit for the Foundation. And then I said an AIDS ride then.
You've had a long and varied past as a high wheel rider. How long have you been riding high?
Well, actually, I've been collecting the antique bikes since 1983. That's when I began, when I found my first bike in 1983 at an old flea market. And just the whole aura of it just hooked me. And within a year, I had acquired my first bike. So by 1984, I had acquired my first ordinary, or high wheel, as everybody calls them, but I prefer to call them an ordinary. And it was in total decrepit shape. It originally belonged to a Japanese company who had it in their collection, and they went under, and in their bankruptcy, auctioned off stuff. And I acquired it through the man who bought it at an auction. And about 1986, I restored it. And it was the first ride, which was a 125-mile ride in the Yosemite Valley, which was actually my first century ride. And I did 125 miles in, unless I started at 6, I finished at 2 in the afternoon.
So what bike did you do that ride on, Jox?
Well, that first one was my only in Jeffrey's American Light Champion, which was very unique bike, yeah.
So you didn't find the G&J at a flea market then?
No. It was a G&J I rode in Yosemite. No, the first bike I found at Flea Market was a 1941 Mercury Pacemaker, a balloon tire classic.
So in ramping up for your ride, had you rolled lots of miles? Did you train a lot before you did your first high wheel ride?
No, bicycling has been in my blood since I was a little kid, so distance I'd already done, by that time I'd already done 5 Davis double centuries, and a countless number of regular centuries on regular road bikes. So distance and duration were not a problem. I was commuting to work by bike already 7 years by then, and so it was just the matter of first, I learned how to ride a 54-inch Stinger, and that was 5 minutes on a basketball lot, basketball court, and that was where I did my taste of my first header, which was what I call a warm-up header because of what I was doing. As I was riding the bike, I got on, and one thing you don't do on an ordinary is stand on the pedal as it's coming up, as you would on a modern bike to adjust yourself in the seat. And that little reflex, I went head forward over the handlebars, and my spotter caught me, and I wound up doing a handstand, and I have a great picture of me in this handstand, the rear wheel pointing straight up in the air. And after that, I learned never stand on the pedal. And so it was 5 minutes around the basketball court, and I took off with the group, and we did a 10-mile ride, which was my first official high wheel tour. So within one day, I went from riding around the parking lot, or riding around a basketball court, to doing my first 10-miler on hilly country, which was pretty kind of scary for the first time.
So was that up in Sacramento somewhere?
No, that was in San Jose. They have a nice little bike path down there. Not as nice as ours here. It has a lot of very narrow trails and big roots sticking in, make it for kind of scary on an ordinary. And it's very narrow and little hills all over it. Definitely not the heaven here.
You've easily got one of the best bike commutes in the world there from Rancho Cordova to Sacramento, where you work for the state of California, along the American River. Have you been making that bike commute for as long as you work for the state?
It's my first year. I was getting settled in the job, and then within that year, I figured out my route, and I began my riding by bike from there on, and then for essentially 24, almost 25 years, I've been bicycle commuting.
So how many miles a week are you bike commuting?
At this point, 200 a week.
You're car free, are you not?
Yeah, I used to have a car, but the friend I was using it, and it got caught in an accident when somebody cut in front of him. And I said, I'm not going to use a car for a while. I found, for the years I had one out of a week. I might use it 2 days. And I said, well, what's the point of weighing down the driveway and wasting my money? So when the car got smashed up, I took the insurance money out of the Bahamas and then came back and said, instead I think I'll just go without a car for a while. And then what I do is on a weekend, when I need one, I'll rent one for a couple of days and take it back by the end of the weekend, and I'm done. It works out pretty well.
So often do you find yourself in a car?
Once a month. You do it at the beginning, you do get my grocery shopping, do a few errands, that sort of thing, and then drop it back off. It's pretty cheap. I might do it twice a month if there's something special happening.
Coming back to high bikes, what's the furthest you've ever ridden one in a day?
Furthest in a day was my European record, which was at Worms, Germany, and it was 206 miles in 14 and a half hours.
Wow, this is a major feat, guy. You don't crash a lot. You told me you don't go down all that very often. Besides the one header that you took when you first got into high wheel riding, were there other occasions where that was the case?
Well, I did one other header, and again, I call it a fun header because it was kind of a funny circumstance. I was riding, and we were on our return back from Switzerland. We were a bunch of us rode our high wheels and other bikes from Arnhem, Holland, into the Swiss Alps and back in over a 2.5-week period. And we were returning back down the Rhine, and we were on a stretch of trail, and somebody in front of me in a safety who was not too conscious about other traffic stopped suddenly, and two of us were behind them, and the both of us had to veer, and I wound up veering into some soft, shaley material, and ultimately I hit a hummock, and it would stop my front wheel, and I rolled over the handlebar very slowly and landed in a big heap of grass, and so I came up laughing, and we're all laughing about the whole thing.
How often do you ride your high wheel to work?
Oh, I just do it maybe a couple of times. I do it, mostly I try to focus on the day we have our bike to work. which is, if it's already wired to work, there's not too much I can do to make that any more special. So the way I make it special is I take one of my antique bikes out and say, so my statement is, well, it doesn't matter what you ride, you don't have to ride something fancy, just as long as it works and it works fine. And so I make the point by bringing in, oh, my 1889 Eagle, 1884 Humber, the 86 G&J, or maybe it'd be my 1895 Columbia Model 40, or it might be my 1945 World War II Swiss Army bike. Or it could be the 1947 Schwinn cycle plane. You never know.
So it sounds to me like you ride mostly diamond frames to work, just regular standard uprights.
Well, I have a small selection of bikes now. I have a what I call my commuterized Mongoose, which is a mountain bike, which I converted it more to be a commuter. I put high pressure 26 by 1 1/4 tires on it. I have fenders, I have a rear rack, and I have a dual beam night sun headlight and all the goodies to make it trail worthy in case I should have a breakdown. I carry tools and spare tubes and that type of stuff. And then when the weather gets warmer, I bring out the Raleigh Supercourse that I converted up with a set of Blumhouse fender, and I've got a rack on it, and I use my Cat-Eye Blinky 5 LED headlight, which works well in the spring and summer. And I'm building up a Vicount 1-speed, which is a nice about a 58-inch gear, which lets me spin a comfortable 23 to 25 miles an hour. And so I'm working on that, and I'm building up an old specialized mountain bike with a drop bar and a few other weird things to make it a little different from the other ones. So I'll have two winter bikes and two summer bikes that I can rotate through.
So how often are you riding the high wheel with all those bikes you've got there?
I just take it out for spins. It might be, 20, 40, or 60 mile day ride or something like that. So. It just varies on my mood and projects. Otherwise, like right now, I'm in the midst of restoring an 1897 Stearns Yellow Fellow tandem and an 1897 Cleveland tandem that I recently acquired. And so new projects come up that get me busy doing that. So I just ride when I feel like it, and I restore when I feel like it.
So I'm sure if you're like me here all the time, how do you stop that thing? Can you do a track stand, Jocks?
I don't track stand well on my regular bikes. I do. I can track stand for hours, but on my ordinary, I do a slow roll, which is close to track stand. I mean, I'm just maybe moving an inch every 2 seconds or something like that. I don't come to a dead stop.
How about a pedal dismount?
The pedals and dismounts a little difficult on the ordinary because you have to watch the backbone and the saddle. Pedal dismount on the Eagle is really actually the most practical way to get off.
When Jacques says Eagle, he's referring to a high wheel bicycle where the high wheel is the rear wheel, the smaller wheels in the front. So, Jacques, can you do a pedal mount?
Never really taught myself to do the pedal mount. I sort of think, well, what's the point? I mean, I do something if I need to, but when I find that the rolling step mount is just perfectly adequate, I don't need to do the, I do the pedal. I do the pedal mount on the Eagle. That freaks people out.
We'll talk about freaking people out. I just learned the emergency dismount. Can you do one of those?
Yes, I've bailed out a couple of times that way. It's a pretty handy one to know. Yeah, that is definitely a good one to know. That's a very important.
You've seen a lot of the world on a high wheeler, or should I say, a lot of the world has seen you. How many countries have you visited on a high wheel bicycle?
Let's see. 1989, I rode from Arnhem, Holland, to the Swiss Alps. So I went through essentially Holland, Belgium, Germany, France, and Switzerland. And in 1989, later 89, I rode around Japan. So in 1990, I was invited to Australia, so I went down there and I rode around in Tasmania, and I hold a 100 mile record down there. And in 1993, I went back.
You say you set a 100 mile high wheel record. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
1990, I was invited to attend the big Evandale races and Victorian Fair they have there. And one of the events they hosted the week before, which was a publicity thing, was a local family down there by the name of the Hallams, had an ancestor named Thomas Hallam, who had an 1886 Ordinary, and he rode his bike from a point south of Evandale, which is where we had the races, to the place, the capital city of Hobart in southern Tasmania, and they rode what they call now the Midlands Highway. And so they figured out the exact route, and they got his time, which was 9 hours, I think a little over 9 hours. And so they put us to the test to see who could break the record. And so it was about 11 of us, and I wasn't going to dilly-dally, and we all started at the same time, and I just took my time and rode my pace, which is on the average sustained 20 to 22 miles an hour on flat land. And by the time I reached Hobart, I had knocked 90 minutes off the time.
You're getting 20 to 22 miles an hour on a high wheel?
About 20 to 22.
How big of a wheel are you doing that on?
That's with the 55.
Okay, some guy from a TV station dared you, he raced you, and you beat him pretty good, too. Tell us about that.
Yeah, back when we first started the Cyclebration Classic, we got Dare Dave, I can't think of his last, he was the sportscaster for Channel 40, and he had a little program as Dare Dave, and you get to dare him to do any sport you want that you know, and we picked Ordinary, and we did a 100-meter sprint, and of course, they blew the poor guy off. It was pretty fun. Yeah, it was just a short little 100-meter sprint, yeah.
So did you give the guy a break, or was this from a standing stop?
Oh, yeah, the best way to race and the fair way to race is you do a standing mount. You get going.
So did this poor guy get a chance to at least get used to the bike? Had he trained with it or spent any time learning how to mount it?
Yeah. Oh, we had pre-arranged it. We had it pre-arranged, and they gave him a little time to get practice, and they borrowed the rideable replicoids to use, and so he got a little practice, the feel of it and everything like that. So we set him out on the course, and off we went.
Okay, you like to go fast on a bicycle. I understand that you're also building one. Tell us about that.
Okay, well, I was just, minding my own business, building and restoring my old antiques, and I got a call from a man who, actually an email, and he said he was interested in building antique bicycles, and he liked antique guns, and he had some collections of reproduction antiques, including one of a certain period Colt 45 revolver, and so anyway, I said, I'd be interested in helping him, and I thought it would be a small thing where he was going to build a bike for himself or something like that. I didn't realize the magnitude. And anyway, so we got to communicating, and I learned a little about him. The man is apparently, he's a descendant from good old Wild Bill Hickok. But anyway, he described his project. I said, yeah, I'd be happy to help. So what we have done is set about recreating from scratch the original bicycles, certain select models and years of various antique bicycles, primarily of American manufacture, to essentially focus on the American collector groups. And one that I'd like to call the Volkswagen of Ordinaries was the Columbia Expert, which was built only from the 1880 up until 1892 when they stopped producing Ordinaries. And I chose model as the first one because there are so many originals out there that not only could we make the original like the original, I mean, make a reproduction like the original, but we could also make parts that would allow collectors to be able to restore theirs or maintain theirs. So it was a double, sort of a double focus on there. So we set about measuring each component. I sat down, took one completely apart, and measured each component and transcribed it into digital CAD. And then using all that information, we recreated scratch, a complete Ordinary. And they're now in production.
I don't think I quite followed that. What was the transition between guns and high wheel bikes? Take us through the segue, if you will.
Well, the man liked the quality of the guns he built and that he got, and he thought his idea would be to create a bicycle along the same sentiment as these people were doing with guns, as people were paying these vast amounts of money for essentially reissues of original arms and the avid gun collectors, and he thought he wanted to do that for the bicycle collecting group or for people who wanted these types of bikes. And I was kind of the two-fort kind of thing. You not only are creating something that's collectible, but you're creating something that people can actually get out and ride and not have to worry about breaking because it's solid brand new steel. And even if you did break something, you're not destroying an original, which is once it's gone, it's gone. You can go back and you can get parts and replace it. But the ones we're making are all those solid stainless steel, so you're going to have to, hit it with an atomic bomb to break it.
So what about metal fatigue? Have you ever purchased a bike where that's been a problem?
Yeah, the metal's breaking down. In my own personal experiences, I've only had very small parts break, so it's not been a problem. I think mainly because when I select the bike, I make sure I find one that's in good shape. But it's bound to happen, which is another reason why we want to build these, is to avoid a person getting caught in a situation where one of these fails, and they do fail. We've had many along on our trip in the Holland trip that metal parts broke on them and things, so crank arms and stuff like that.
So, is there any way you can know ahead of time what to be on the lookout for?
Well, when you're buying, in the first office is to try to look at the main condition of it at time of purchase. Like, if it's really rusted and corroded and pitted, there's a good chance you may have some metal failure. If you really have to study it, and the more you can find one in better condition, the better off. But it's not saying that it's going to be totally bad, because it could be surface rust, and once you get through that, the metal could be perfectly fine and shiny. So you won't know until you really start getting into it and taking the rust off and studying it. Then that's where you'll see possibility of hairline fractures or previous repairs that have been kind of hidden, especially if they repaired it and repainted it, and the paint may hide the repair will have that. When you strip it off, you'll find that. So it's definitely one of those caveat emptor types of situations in antique bicycles.
So, do you have a website yet for your new bike company?
Yeah, it's called elgenon.org.
Can you spell that out for us?
ALGENON.org. Yeah, we have a website. You can look at it, and you can actually, there's a model you can download that allows you to view the entire bicycle down to the nut and bolt.
What does Algernon mean?
In Greek means new beginning.
And when are these bikes going to hit the market?
Well, we tend to peg it sometimes towards the spring.
This spring?
Spring of 06, yeah.
Wow, it sounds like you guys are really blazing.
Yeah, I mean, we have it. We are online now, but the bicycle, we're now in the midst of producing the you might call it the frame component. That's the backbone, the front and rear forks, the rims and stuff. We're now in the midst of doing it.
Here now with our third annual Gold Run coming up from Folsom to Davis, where there will probably be about 10 or so high-wheel bicycles. How often is it the case that you've seen that many of the ordinaries, the penny farthings, the high-wheel bikes in one place at one time? I mean, it's quite a spectacle.
How often do you find 10 high wheels in one spot? Not around here, not very often. I'm about the only ordinary in this area. So it's a pretty once in a blue moon type event. I mean, I used to host every winter a meet down in Carmel, which was a lot of fun. We'd ride from Carmel up to Pacific Grove and back along the 17-mile drive, which is an ideal, almost as ideal as our parkway here for riding an ordinary. A challenging spot is the first 2 miles out leaving Carmel, because it's one steep hill on the way out and a few steep ones going through Pebble Beach.
So is that right, pretty much it for the far west, for California?
Nope, this is pretty much it, other than maybe the Stanford event, which is just a mile loop and a few little slaloms and stuff, or the Davisville, which is no longer active, so it's just been a catch as catch can is really what it is.
So having all these bikes together in one place is really kind of a rare thing then.
Yeah, I mean, there are meets all over the place, but it's the same thing. They may have one in one state, one in another state, one in another state. So you essentially have to be a gypsy traveling around to find these things. That's why actually I'm trying to get these bicycles out, so that more people can have them, that more people will tend to be riding them, and that maybe there'll be more type of activities in the future.
So are you looking forward to July 23rd?
Yeah, I always am. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to doing that again.
Okay, well, we've reached that point in the interview where we've got to start wrapping things up. Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, other than, you know, look for the Ordinaries coming out on Algernon.org and look for seeing us out on the road sometime in the near future. And you too might want to get a hold of one and enjoy what it's like in high life.
So besides bikeroute.com/JacquesGraber, how else can someone find you?
All they have to do is just type in Jacques Graber on Google and you'll find out a lot of about 5 pages.
Can you give us the exact spelling on your name?
Okay, JacquesQuess, GraBer.
Well, as usual, it's been a pleasure and a treat talking to you, Jacques. I guess we'll just see you July 23rd.
Oh, okay, yeah, well, we'll see you then.
Thanks for taking time for us today, guy. And just thanks for you.
Okay, you take care.
That wraps up another edition of the National Bicycle Greenways Mountain Movers podcast series. We hope you enjoyed it. This has been NBG director and Awake Again author Martin Krieg. For more info about the NBG, go to nationalbicyclegreenway.com. To access this podcast in the future and to hear other shakers and movers that we've interviewed, go to bikeroute.com.